Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Bob Costa, Bureau Chief for National Review in Washington, D.C., and for Jim Garrity today, who's on vacation this week. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Bob, first of all, welcome. Your first time on the Three Martini Lunch. Great to have you. We start with the good news today, and we're expecting these big decisions from the Supreme Court this week. We sort of got our first one on Monday. We still have at least two others to go. And the one we got today was on affirmative action. The court essentially vacating the previous verdict. They did not shoot down, as some had hoped, the 2003 University of Michigan decision, which said you can't use race for specific points in terms of admissions, but it can be a factor. This was seen by a lot of people, perhaps, as a chance to rub out affirmative action admissions altogether. The court sending it back to the lower court, saying that it just hasn't been dealt with properly. The good news here, though, certainly, is that it looks like only one justice here, Justice Ginsburg, still believes, at least publicly, in that sort of preferences when it comes to admissions.
I think we haven't seen the end of this discussion in America, Greg. And the courts really reflect, I think, where the public debate is. The legal implications of affirmative action have not really been settled by the Supreme Court. They threw it back to the lower courts. I think this could lead to a lot more cases about affirmative action programs around the country, about whether these programs make sense. And I think you're going to see some more challenges in the lower courts and maybe back again in the Supreme Court.
And a lot of things conservatives are looking at today are the comments from Justice Clarence Thomas, who said that he would have actually voted to overturn the University of Michigan decision from 2003. Justice Scalia, for example, saying he didn't do that because the litigants never asked the court to do that. But in terms of the way Justice Thomas looked at this, he says it is also noteworthy that in our desegregation cases, we rejected arguments that are virtually identical to those advanced by the university today. The university asserts, for instance, that the diversity obtained through its discriminatory admissions program prepares its students to become leaders in a diverse society. The segregationists likewise defended segregation on the ground that it provided more leadership opportunities for blacks. And, Bob, obviously the liberals are going to be howling at that comparison, but I think a lot of people, either silently or loudly, are nodding along.
You know, fascinating development. So often when these kind of cases, especially the more complicated cases, come before the court, it's Antonin Scalia. Justice Scalia, who's really giving the left a lot of heartburn and headaches. But today it was Thomas, usually a quiet justice on the conservative side. When he joined in the majority opinion today and helped send it back to the lower court, his concurrent opinion is going to be around as a not only a legal issue but a political volleyball, I think, for the coming months. Because as this issue remains unsettled, when you have a justice like Thomas talking about segregation and how, quote, the university echoes the hollow justifications advanced by the segregationists, that comes from his concurring opinion, and that he says there's, quote, no principal distinction between the two, that's a stark comment. And it's going to put Thomas back there in the center of the debate. And it shows that Thomas is not afraid to throw a few elbows as he writes his opinions.
I think there'll be a few comments on MSNBC about that tonight.
Oh, I think we'll have a few shows dedicated to it on MSNBC.
All right, on to Martini number two now. And if conservatives are wishing they'd gotten something stronger from the Supreme Court and are glad that they got at least what they did get on that case today, definitely frustrated about what's going on in the U.S. Senate with the immigration debate. It looks like, and even opponents of the new Corker-Hoven version of immigration reform, because that amendment is essentially replacing the whole Gang of Eight bill. Even opponents now admitting that they're probably going to get easily 60 and maybe even 70 votes to shove this over to the House with some momentum. But the fascinating thing here, Bob, is that a lot of the critics are still saying all the Republicans back in 2009, 2010 were railing against the Democrats for passing a major piece of legislation that was over 1,000 pages long without ever actually reading it. And they're saying, essentially, that's the exact same thing that's happening here on this bill. They're just taking the word of the Gang of Eight and of Corker and Hoven here because Republicans think this is what has to be done both politically and policy-wise. So I know you're covering this in a lot of great detail. What's the conservative perspective on this, and what's your reading of the tea leaves on how this will all play out?
It's a great question, Greg. And I think it's a fair point to look at the Senate deliberations and say that they're really mimicking Obamacare. They're passing a bill without reading it. And I think that's very true. But I'd like to make a distinction, because I've heard this argument a lot today at the Capitol. you hear a lot of conservatives up in arms, and rightfully so, because the bill is being rushed in the Senate. The Corker-Hovind amendment that was just elevated last week to be attached to the legislation, most people don't know what it is beyond some vague idea that it's a, quote, border surge. But here's how it's different. Because if this bill passes the Senate with 65, 70 votes, whatever it is, it's rushed. Conservatives howl about it. They can't stand it. The Gang of Eight has its way. The right feels alienated. That's all going to probably happen in this week. But if that happens, it goes over to the House. And when Obamacare was passed and rushed, it was passed quickly by the Senate, quickly by the House. And that process it was almost a whirlwind. And I was on the Capitol, at the Capitol for that whole discussion. And it definitely felt like a tornado of legislation coming through without much consideration and mulling. But the House, I think John Boehner is very hesitant to move quickly on this. You have Bob Goodlatte. He's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He wants to probably break up this Gang of Eight bill into parts, move him through his committee. So I'm very skeptical that this is going to be rushed, but I do understand the frustration and agitation on the right.
Some of the more prominent voices in opposition to what they would call amnesty in this bill, the Louis Gohmert, Steve King, they're out there saying, Bob, that they don't want anything to pass the House because even though the House bill would be, in their opinion, light years better than the Senate bill, once it goes to conference, all bets are off because what comes back to the House would probably get the vast majority of Democrats, and then they would only need to pick off 30 or 40 Republicans to get a bill that the vast majority of House Republicans don't want. So how much are you hearing about that type of strategy?
There is a real fear among the conservatives in the House that even if the House passes its own bill and it comes up with a Goodlatte strategy, something from the Judiciary Committee, or the House Gang of Eight brings up its own bill, this conference committee looms over the entire discussion. Because you're right, it would be like melting metals together. It can be messy, it can be hot, and a lot of people could get burned if they have a system in the conference committee where they try to process these bills into one sausage. But what we're really looking at now is a key question for John Boehner. Does he allow the Gang of Eight's bill, should it pass the Senate, to come to the House floor? And if he does, he's really going to have some political problems because that would be breaking the so-called Hastert rule, which means that a speaker who's a Republican should never bring a piece of legislation to the floor unless it has a majority of the majority's support. And if Boehner brings the Gang of Eight's bill to the floor, that likely means he's bringing a bill to the floor that only has some Republican support. And that's going to mean he's going to need Democrats to pass it. Does Boehner, looking ahead at his legacy, looking at his own views, maybe let that happen? I think that's definitely a possibility. But he could lose the support of the right flank of his conference if he does that.
What's a bigger issue? Exit question on this martini, Bob. For most Republicans that support this Corker-Hovind bill, do they think it's because it's going to solve the border security problem, or do they think they have to pass something because of the political implications?
I think it's a mix of both. I think the Corker-Hovind is more political cover than anything. People even who are for border security and for spending more on the border are skeptical that all these border agents and this surge of spending is somehow going to really solve the problem. At the end of the day, the real immigration debate in Congress has been about path to legalization. You're either for it or you're against it. And just because border security has been able to woo a few Republicans in the Senate over to the side of a path to legalization, that doesn't mean the House Republicans are going to do it. And there's a concern that this is not just something that makes sense legislatively as a conservative. It's a lot of spending. You could almost argue as a conservative that the border surge, the Hovind-Corker, is stimulus spending. And it doesn't give the states a lot of power. It's a lot of federal power on the border. And so that makes a lot of people raise their eyebrows, especially on the right side.
On to the third martini now. And for most people, tomorrow is Tuesday. It's also Tuesday in Massachusetts, but it's a special election day because voters will go to the polls to decide who is the senator from that state to fill out the rest of John Kerry's term. John Kerry, of course, resigned when he became Secretary of State earlier in the year. Ed Markey, longtime member of Congress, won the Democratic nomination. Former Navy SEAL Gabriel Gomez is the Republican nominee. It's a state that obviously leans to the left, although we got the Scott Brown a surprise win back in the special election to fill out Ted Kennedy's term in 2010. That was largely due to Scott Brown's opposition to the president's health care plan. Ultimately, they were able to get that done even with his opposition in place. Right now, Markey consistently holds a slim but steady lead. He's usually under 50%, but Gomez can't seem to get within about 5 or 6 or 7 points here. Bob, it's crazy that it's actually that close, but the question is, can he actually get over the finish line?
It is kind of a crazy martini, Greg, because every poll says Gomez does not have much of a chance. He's behind, as you say, by 5 to 10 points, even 20 points in some polls. But this is a strange little election. It's in late June. It's when a lot of people in Massachusetts are paying attention to the Boston Bruins being in the playoffs. They're out on the beach, at the shore, at the Cape. Anything can happen in a low turnout election, and especially in a special election that people aren't really paying attention to. A recent poll said only 40% of Massachusetts voters are even paying attention to the race. And in that scenario, you could have a crazy situation where Ed Markey underperforms, the Democratic congressman who's the Democratic nominee, and Gabe Gomez actually ascends and does better than expected and makes this race really competitive. I'm doubtful about that happening. I have a piece up at NRO today about that being unlikely, but it could happen, and that's something I'm looking for that's a little crazy this week.
From a conservative perspective, when you take a look at Gabriel Gomez's policy positions, he's for the Gang of Eight bill for the most part. He's certainly for that type of immigration reform. He's largely for gun control. He's liberal on the social issues. And so he'd probably be a little bit different maybe on economics and national security. But if he were to win, how excited should conservatives be about that?
I'm not so sure how excited they should be. They should be excited in the sense that if Gomez wins, which I think, of course, is not happening, but if it does happen in some surprising situation, he would be very much in the Susan Collins, Olympia Snow wing of the party, a Northeast moderate, a Northeast centrist. He has rallied against the Republican Party at several junctures in this campaign. He has called out the party for making, quote, stupid comments about social issues. He has never been in elected office, so no one's really sure about where he stands on several conservative issues. He's for immigration reform. He's for gay marriage. And so I think it'd be great for the Republican Party, if you're Mitch McConnell, to have another Republican in the Senate. But Gabe Gomez is no guaranteed vote for most Republican legislation, but neither was Scott Brown, who won the seat in 2010.
We'll be watching tomorrow night to see if the polls were right. Bob, great to have you with us. Great job. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Greg.
Bob Costa is the bureau chief in Washington for National Review. You can read his articles at nationalreview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus. For Radio America, please join us again on Tuesday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.